start our May board meeting. Begin with insurance amendments to IFRS 4. I give the floor to Joanne.
So good afternoon. This session and completes staff's planned technical decisions for this project. We will start off with two papers, 14B and 14C, which covers off proposals in the ED. Then we are asking you to consider two further exceptions that wasn't proposed in the exposure draft, one for the equity method and the other for the first-time adopter. All going well, we will be asking for permission to ballot after this. So I'll hand it over to Conor, who is walking through 14B and 14C.
Thank you, Joanna. So 14B is about reassessment of eligibility for the temporary exemption. At its April meeting, the board decided to require entities to perform an issue assessment of their eligibility for the temporary exemption from applying IFRS 9. As at their annual reporting dates between the 1st of April 2015 and the 31st of March 2016. Paper 14B considers whether entities should be required or permitted to reassess their eligibility after they've made their initial assessment and disclosures that they would need to make if they do reassess their eligibility. I intend to discuss the paper in three sections. I'll start with mandatory reassessment by entities whose activities stop being predominantly related to insurance after their initial assessment. This is covered in paragraphs 7 to 24 of the paper. There are two main issues. First, the staff recommend that the board confirms the ED proposals that entities are required to reassess their eligibility if they have a change in corporate structure that could result in a change in their predominant activities. For example, the acquisition or disposal of a business. Second, staff recommend that an entity that performs a reassessment and becomes ineligible for the temporary exemption needs to apply IFRS 9 at the earlier of the second annual reporting period after the change in corporate structure that changed its predominant activity and the expiry date of the temporary exemption. The staff also recommend that an entity that concludes it is no longer eligible should disclose in the annual reporting period in which it reaches that conclusion and the subsequent annual reporting period before it applies IFRS 9, the fact that it's no longer eligible, the reasons it's no longer eligible, and the date on which the change in corporate structure occurred that made it ineligible. I now turn the discussion over to the board.
Connor, can you clarify for the board what you mean by a change in corporate structure? Are you referring to simply a change in a corporate capitalization, or do you mean something more broadly like changes in business activities? For example, you mentioned acquisitions and disposals of businesses. How limited or how narrow?
So we're after change in structure that can change the business activities. So if a group of companies change from being financed by loans to equity or backwards and forwards, and that doesn't change its business, then that isn't going to cause a reassessment. So I guess predominantly we're thinking of people who buy a banking business or sell an insurance business, that sort of thing. But it is a change in corporate structure that's going to affect the business they do. Is it going to cause them to start being predominantly insurer or stop being predominantly insurer? But we do have this cutoff that you have to have a change in corporate structure that does this. We didn't want people to sort of drift in and out of eligibility. I hope that helps. And we are thinking, we probably will put an example in, if you're willing, to say that a change in financing that doesn't change the business is not going to trigger a reassessment. I hope that helps.
Okay. I'm happy with the proposal. I just want to hear confirmation that this would work in a symmetric way to get you in or out of the eligibility for the exemption. I mean, if an entity failed on day one, the test of these 80-90% because it has an activity which makes it a non-predominantly insurance business, and would later on dispose of that activity and become eligible, that would work. The other way around, if the entity did qualify but makes a big acquisition which no longer makes it qualified, it would get it out of the... So it's kind of symmetric.
It is symmetrical, but yeah. We're requiring people to see if they fall out, and we're allowing people to
course,
come in because it's
optional. Yes, you're not
optional.
Forced to adopt the exemption if you are not. That's
but it is, yeah, that's right.
And just for clarity, question 1 and 2 talks about mandatory reassessment. Question three is the optional. So combined all together, you will get symmetrical treatment if you bought both question 1, 2, and 3.
Symmetrical.
I think this symmetry is fair to prepare us. I would like to see that it's just going both ways in the same way.
Sure. But it is symmetrical subject to the override that if you have already applied.
No, of course. It will work in the period until 2018 where you have not yet had to adopt IFRS 9. After that, too late.
I think I might be jumping ahead.
Okay.
All right.
So any other comments on question 1 and 2, which is just mandatory reassessment? So you are eligible on the date of assessment. You are required to reassess if you have a change in corporate structure. We will get to Philippe's point in question 3 about the optional reassessment.
I will just confirm something. I think it's the right place. I just wanted to double check. So let's say that I decide to start an insurance business.
Okay.
I announce to the world I'm going to start the insurance business. So that's a potential change in
activity.
But it would only be once I test that it's actually affected my balance sheet that it would cause me to change the assessment, because it's still based on the ratio. But the trigger for when you think about it is this corporate action.
Well, it's actions. But, you know, if you've had a change in corporate structure, then that makes you reassess, and then you perform the predominance calculation. But something's got to happen. It's not just an intention.
Yeah.
Okay.
So any discussion on the fact that we're given an additional year as well? That's part of question 2. Just to be clear, that's what we're asking you to vote on, question 1 and 2.
Compared with the...
Sounds reasonable.
So all in favour. Okay. So question 3.
So this goes to Philippe's point. We'll now consider the optional reassessment of eligibility for entities that initially assessed that are ineligible. This is covered in paragraphs 25 to 31. And it was bringing the date of the initial assessment forward before the effective date of IFRS 9 that created this window in which people could become eligible before they apply IFRS 9. And the staff recommends, as we've just said to Philippe, really, that entities that become eligible for temporary exemption before 2018 should be able to apply the temporary exemption in the same way as entities that were eligible at initial assessment and remain that way. The staff recommend that an entity that becomes eligible in this way discloses, as part of the explanation of how it concluded it was eligible for the temporary exemption, the reason for the reassessment, an explanation of the change in predominant activities, and the date on which the change in corporate structure occurred that made it eligible.
Just clarify the timing. If this corporate event, this event takes place very early in 2018, but I have to apply the test, the calculation, to the prior year financial statements, just a question, succession of events and looking back to the prior year to do the calculation. Can you?
So it was sometime during 2018, you sell your banking business. Is that what you're thinking of?
I do an acquisition, and then I have to mandatory reassess. I'm just not sure about the succession of events that could straddle the 1/1/18 date, and the fact that you actually do the test on the prior year financial statement.
That's the next one. You do the test on the next balance sheet.
Immediately follows.
Oh, that's interesting.
And that was how I understood Sue's question, actually, is that this triggers the reassessment.
Yes.
But the assessment is a facts-based reassessment, so you have to look at the effect of the event on your reassessment
on the next
process.
Balance sheet.
Mm, okay. Yeah. I may follow. Yeah, okay. Right. Yeah, okay.
I just wanted to comment on the disclosures to say that I agree, because I think that what we what we need to be, I think it would be helpful here to have market discipline around the fact that it's a real change in structure, if you like, that initiates the reassessment, given that it's all based on this concept that it's meant to be sort of an unusual event, if you like. Mm-hmm. So I agree with particularly with those disclaimers.
Thank you.
So we're asking about questions 3 and 4.
All in favour?
Okay. Can I just ask a follow-up? This relates to, I think, an observation that Darrell just made. So if, for example, I enter into a sale or an acquisition, a definitive agreement is reached on December the 30th or 31st, I don't have a closing of the transaction. I have a definitive agreement, though.
No.
Okay.
You haven't changed.
No.
So I can't use a pro forma as of that date.
No.
So that year I wouldn't qualify. I'd have to wait till say March 31 the next time I
when
cut a balance sheet.
Done. Yeah.
But remember, we're only asking optional reassessment before IFRS 9 becomes mandatory. So you.
Until 31st of December 2017.
Yeah.
So you may maybe in the description of the basis function make it clear that the classification under IFRS 5 held with a view to dispose of the business does not impact that assessment. It's not the only classification. The accounting classification is not the corporate event that would trigger the reassessment. It has to be completed.
We're going to have to be careful.
Because people might, under IFRS 5, present on the balance sheet that asset on a different basis that would trigger some different calculation of the ratio of liabilities on predominant test.
Like discontinued operations?
Discontinued, that was fine. That was my question. Does it impact the mechanisms? Think about it, but maybe in the basis for conclusions, clarify that it doesn't impact.
Yeah, I think we are going to have to be careful how we articulate it, because if I look, say I'm somebody who sold a banking business. Mm-hmm. We have to be clear that we mean after it's sold, as opposed to
on the way,
not when I committed to sell, if you like, because if we make them do the test while it's still on their balance sheet, they're not going to meet the test, even if ultimately they would. And so we're going to have to be very careful on the timing of the test relative to exactly what has happened.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, let's move to the next paper.
Sorry, we have one more question.
But it is the final point in this paper, and that concerns additional guidance on when to reassess eligibility. This is covered in paragraphs 32 to 34. As we have seen in questions 1 and 3, the staff are recommending that the trigger for reassessing is a demonstrable change in corporate structure that could result in a change in the predominant activities of an entity. A few stakeholders asked for guidance on how to identify such a transaction, and in response to these requests, the staff have recommended the guidance set out in question 5, and the wording there is borrowed from IFRS 9 on a change in business model. I think the essence of it is, though, that, you know, it's got to be a significant, the transaction's got to be significant to its operations. We don't want a small little transaction coinciding with other reasons for changes in the makeup of your liabilities triggering a reassessment. You know, there has to be significant to the operations and demonstrable to its liabilities. It's tightening up a bit more about what sort of change in corporate structure would be a trigger.
So,
maybe I would, but I think it's helpful because I think it makes it, firstly, it makes it clear that we mean it's a big deal and it's something external. And I think using words that we've got elsewhere that I think people are starting to understand is a good discipline and hopefully helpful to people. So I think it's a good way of providing the clarification people seem to be looking for.
Okay, then we are ready to
talk about the question 5.
Yeah. Okay, lovely.
All in favour?
That was good.
Okay, go ahead.
Move on to paper 14C, which is deals with several aspects of the temporary exemption and override approach. I propose to discuss each topic in turn. quite a few of them I think I'll go over quite quickly because I don't think that. The first one, though, is in paragraphs 3 to 12, and we consider the fixed expiry date for the temporary exemption. As noted in paper 14A, the board tentatively decided in March that there should be a fixed expiry date for the temporary exemption, and the staff are recommending that the board confirms the ED proposal that the temporary exemption expires no later than annual reporting periods beginning on or after the 1st of January 2021. Based on the staff's expectations of when the forthcoming insurance contract standard is likely to be effected and this fixed expiry date, an entity could first apply IFRS 9 and the new standard at the first time. I'll now just pass over to the board for they agree with this recommendation.
Mm-hmm. No comments?
All in favour?
Silence is approval, yes.
Okay. So, all in favour?
All in favour. Yeah.
So we now consider whether an entity should be permitted to stop applying for temporary exemption. This is covered in paragraphs 13 to 15. The staff don't think it would be appropriate to prohibit anyone from applying IFRS 9 because IFRS 9 is an improvement on IS 39. Consequently, the staff are recommending that an entity can choose to apply IFRS 9 and do so at the beginning of any subsequent annual reporting period. So, board members have questions or comments on this recommendation.
All in favour?
This one and the chain.
Yes.
This could be similar. This is considering transition to IFRS 9, and this is covered in paragraphs 16 to 18. ED proposed that an entity should apply the transition requirements of IFRS 9, may apply the overlay approach. The staff see no compelling reason to amend these proposals.
All agreed.
All agreed. Question 3 in the paper.
All in favour.
Next one was one that didn't come up in the ED, and that's about a fixed expiry for the overlay approach. A few respondents to the comment letters did suggest this. The ED did not propose a fixed expiry date for the overlay approach. Instead, an entity will be required to stop applying the overlay approach when it first applies the forthcoming insurance contract. The staff do not see a compelling reason to amend these proposals for the reasons set out in paragraphs 19 to 21. Do board members have any questions or comments on this recommendation?
I have a question. So let's say you elected to apply the temporary exemption and you can apply that any time after January 1, 21. Okay?
Yeah.
But if you elect the overlay approach and there's a delay in the effective date of the insurance contract standard beyond what perhaps we're anticipating, you could have a situation where you're applying that indefinitely, at least for, you know. Does that make sense?
Well, it's not indefinite, but the overlay approach provides information. It's very visible. People can if they don't, users can unwind it sort of in their minds if they want to. I don't. We see no downside.
You know, it raises the question of whether or not it's past its sale date. You know, in terms of a lot of this debate and issue is around things like cost and relevance and issues like that. You go 4 or 5 years out into the future.
Well, should you
continue to be able to
stop with the insurance contract standard, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But that's the point. What if insurance contracts goes 4 or 5 years out into the future?
But I think that's appropriate. I mean, going back to RED, the overlay was developed to address what people were concerned about in terms of additional mismatches that they thought would be created by adopting the the asset standard without the liability standard, and also volatility that would result. To me, the overlay is a way to address that in the interregnum, and it does, you know, some might argue give additional information about the expected effect of the new insurance standard. So to me, what the staff has proposed about the overlay is the right approach, because it makes that overlay available for the entity to decide whether or not it's worth the additional cost of applying it for the period in which they think there will be a mismatch.
So one against?
That's not so sure.
13.
13.
And that just comes to the final point in 14. Effective dates for the temporary exemption in the overlay. They're set out in question 5 and 9. And does the board any comments? Does the board agree with those recommendations?
All in favour?
Good papers, Colin.
Well, thank you.
Right. We now move on to 14D. And that's Jane.
Okay. Thanks, Ryan. Good afternoon, everybody. Paper 14D looks at proposals for some additional relief for investors in associates and joint ventures. The exposure that's proposed, and the board has subsequently confirmed, that eligibility for the use of the temporary exemption will be assessed at the reporting entity level. In addition, IS 28, that deals with interest in associates and joint ventures, requires that an investor, when it's applying the equity method, should make adjustments to the financial statements of its investee to align the investee's accounting policies with the investor's own accounting policies before bringing in its share of the investee's results and net assets through the equity method. A few responders to the exposure draft noted that where an investor applies IFRS 9, but the investee takes the temporary exemption and applies IS 39 in its own financial statements, there may be significant practical difficulties in obtaining the information that's necessary to amend that investee's financial statements in order to conform its accounting policies with the investors, and therefore those respondents asked the board to provide some relief from the requirements of IS 28 to apply consistent accounting policies. Although the majority of those respondents asking focused on the investor applying IFRS 9 but the investee applying the temporary exemption, a couple of them also noted that if it was the other way round, the same practical difficulties may well apply. The staff support the respondents' requests, and therefore in paragraph 29 of the paper do recommend the board to provide that relief from consistent accounting policies in IS 28 for this purpose. You'll also see in paragraph 36 to paragraph 40 that the staff do not believe that the same relief is required if the overlay approach is being used rather than IS 39, the temporary exemption. And our reasons are given in those paragraphs. The overlay approach is a designation approach, so does not have to be used for all eligible financial assets. So if the investor is applying to some assets that the investee is not, then the designation approach will actually deal with that scenario. The staff have also looked at disclosures, and the recommendation is that whenever the financial statements of the investee that have been used for the equity method either apply the temporary exemption or apply the overlay approach, the disclosures required in the investee's financial statements are equally applicable to pull up and reproduce in the investor's financial statements, subject to the normal materiality constraints. So our recommendations, which are in paragraphs 41 to 55, are recommending the replication of those disclosures consistently with the existing requirements in IFRS 12 for more detailed financial information of associates and joint ventures. The recommendations are summarised in paragraphs 3 to 7 and in questions 1 to 5 following paragraph 55, but happy to take any comments or questions on the individual parts before looking at your responses to those questions.
Mary?
I have... checking for some almost due process guidance, because I think I agree with the staff's analysis in terms of the right ways to address this issue and the logic for granting the relief. If, you know, within the context of the decision we took at the previous meeting to, to confirm the deferral approach. I'll come to it later on one of the other papers, but I remain in disagreement with the deferral approach. But within that, when I say I support it, my context is if I take the assumption of granting the deferral approach, then I support the extension to the investments in associates for which the equity method is applied.
Thank you.
Sue?
I also support the proposals in the paper. I think it makes sense both for the cost-benefit reasons that, or for the difficulty, practical challenges people have raised, but also because I don't think there's such a loss of information when it's equity method accounting as opposed to, say, a subsidiary, as I said, as being different to the decision about the reporting entity level generally. But I did just want to clarify one thing. The disclosure recommendations that you have in the paper, which I'm fine with, but I just wanted to confirm, even though this is done in the context of a paper talking about where the investor and the investee are doing different things, if I were in a world where, say, both the investor, and the investee were deferring IFRS 9,
right,
we'd still want these disclosures to be provided in respect of the investee's assets if they're material.
Yeah, definitely. So it's the disclosures that we're recommending apply if the investee is using either the deferral approach or the overlay, and the investor retains that treatment. And so, yeah, it would pull in those disclosures.
Thank you.
I support the proposal. I had a little concern about the investment by investment choice, which allows for some cherry picking. The whole concept here of this relief is based on the difficulty of obtaining information and the cost benefit of that. If an investor has two or three investees and each of them is in the same situation in terms of information being available or not available, I would think that a consistent choice of whether or not to apply the relief would have been expected when similar conditions apply. And I would like the spirit to be reflected that it's not a free choice to apply or not this relief. It depends on facts and circumstances more than just I like to apply the relief or I don't like, given the effect, positive or negative, on my financial situation. I know it's hard to make it operational because it's facts-based, but I like the basis for conclusions to explain that the reason for this relief is based on the difficulties of obtaining information, and not the fact that you like the effect on your financial statements.
I prefer not to do that personally, because I think it'll be difficult to define when we'd think it was okay or not, because I think it's going to be both a sort of practical consideration, but also sort of how big is the consequence and et cetera. It's going to be quite a nuanced decision with different factors being weighed differently by different people. But in terms of the cherry-picking point, I presume this is like an irrevocable election, so you'll choose whether or not you're going to apply the deferral at the sort of associate level. What decision you make on this will be a one-off choice. You can't flip-flop, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
If we could make that clear, that would be, I think, for me, helpful.
And finally, I also support that but I had first struggled a little bit because I think when we had last month we said, okay, that we should not allow the temporary exemption below the reporting entity level, and the main argument was really that we should apply consistent accounting policy, so either IFRS 9 or IAS 39, and here we don't doing that because we're allowing that maybe an associate is IAS 39 and then the rest of the group is IFRS 9. But I really buy this argument that it is a different situation with a kind of associate if you have a subsidiary and you really don't control that. And that is, I think, for me, the main argument why we should give this relief. But I also recognize that it a little bit undermines our argument, which we had last month, not allowing the deferral below the reporting level. But I think, taking all these arguments together, finally, I agree with the staff proposal that we should allow that.
I just wanted to follow up on the exchange about Philippe's suggestion that we say it's subject inconsistency across investees is subject to information availability. Like Sue, I disagree with that. I think we just should rely on the not being able to flip-flop for the same entity. And I think trying to suggest that something should be policed for a relatively short period in terms of assessing availability. I mean, I think of things like, what if the information becomes available 4 days before you're planning to release your financial statements? Is that really available? It just seems like an endless number of questions about something that we want to be, it's something we can do that others can do fast and have it apply for a limited period of time.
I think that's a good point, and part of our thinking behind it, that this relief, and it touches on Martin's points as well, it's not a conceptually sound relief. It's based on the practicalities and the operational difficulties that entities are likely to face.
Can we vote on the recommendations as a whole?
With the clarity that the option is irrevocable. That's tough.
Yeah.
All in favour?
So, the last technical paper for today, for this project anyway. Before we get too excited, it's Marianne's first time adopters.
The first paper?
Oh, yes. First time paper for first time adopter.
Good afternoon. Agenda paper 14A. This paper discusses whether first time adopters should be permitted to apply either the overlay approach or the temporary exemption. Firstly, it discusses the ED proposal that currently prohibits first-time adopters from applying both approaches and the feedback received. And secondly, it analyzes whether this proposal should be amended and whether first-time adopters should be permitted to apply either of those approaches and what modifications should be made to this approaches. Arguments in favor of the prohibition are presented in paragraph 4, while arguments against the prohibition are presented in paragraphs 16 to 21. On balance, staff are recommending that the board should permit first-time adopters to apply the amendments to IFRS 4. If the board decides to permit first-time adopters to apply both approaches, then we suggest the following modifications discussed in paragraphs 22 to 35. On the temporary exemption, first-time adopters should be required to follow the same qualifying criteria as the existing reporters, except for one modification. They should meet the predominance criterion on the date of assessment using carrying amounts of liabilities using applicable IFRS standards. For the reasons stated in paragraphs 22 to 24. Here to note that since you agreed on the optional and mandatory reassessment in agenda paper 14B, these decisions are also applicable to first-time adopters. On the overlay approach, an FTA that applies the overlay approach should follow again what is required for existing reporters, but they must restate comparative information only if they restate comparative information in accordance with IFRS 1 and not in accordance with IFRS 9, because that's only applicable to existing reporters. So the question for the, if you have any questions on these modifications.
Doc.
Yes, when I read this paper, I found lots of discussion whether the national gap is similar to the IFRS 9 or not. But this kind of discussion is totally irrelevant to the actual criteria of this decision. Am I correct?
Yes.
So that means that no matter how different the national gap is, FDA companies can apply this, would be permitted to apply this exemption.
That's correct.
Right, that's so, right. Yeah. That's fine, but because this is very sensitive question because IFRS 9 is a kind of harsh standard. And no matter how similar the standard is, you know, if you did not adopt IFRS, you cannot enjoy the benefit of exemption in the each standard, transitional exemption. So this is the very harsh standard. So, you know, once we started discussing like this, it would invite some lots of, you know, similar things. So we have to make clear that this argument itself is irrelevant to this exemption.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's right. It's irrelevant because the question itself states that they should use IFRS applicable numbers. Because
on
that's
the date of transition.
From the date of assessment. Yes, subject to the decision made on the assessment.
Mary?
Kind of a follow-up on Tak's point. He was asking about whether or not there was an implicit test about the closeness of your national gap to IFRS, and you said, no, there's not. That's just an explanation of why we thought that there might be some demand for it. Mine is something that I think is implicit, but I think we should make absolutely clear in our documents and communications, which is if you qualify, then you still have to adopt IS 39. Yep. You don't get to carry forward your national gap, even if it is very close. Yep. You still have to be a first-time adopter of all of IFRS, including IS 39.
Yeah, you have this information of IS 39.
Yeah, okay.
Yes, that's our intention.
Yes. If you thought that was the intention, you could see it here. It just wasn't absolutely stark, raving, explicit.
So the expectation would be that unless your gap is very close to IS 39, the effort of applying IS 39 for the very first time from a very different starting point and then IS 39.
Yeah. But you still got to move to 39 no matter how similar or otherwise you are.
Right. It isn't, unlike some of the other transition reliefs that we've given, in which you can carry forward your national gap practice, this is different and you're not allowed to do that.
Okay. Do we support staff's recommendation?
All in favor?
All in favor? Okay.
I think the board got something in its lunch.
Maybe it's after lunch. So we now bring you to the due process papers on agenda paper 14F. In this paper, we outline the due process questions to you in page 10. The staff think that the changes that the board has made to the ED proposals during its rejuvenations are not fundamental and respond to the feedback received. Outreach has also been conducted to seek the views of preparers, users of financial statements and regulators. Consequently, we think that on the basis of the re-exposure criteria in the due process handbook, that the proposed amendments to IFRS 4 should be finalised without re-exposure. Secondly, we have looked through the due process steps and noted that we have completed the mandatory and some of the optional due process steps for the permission to ballot to take place. We are requesting permission to start the balloting process. In addition, we are asking if any board members are intending to dissent at this stage. Now, open it up for the board.
So, do we agree that this does not need to be re-exposed?
Agree.
Do we give permission to ballot?
Agree.
All in favor?
And finally, where are the dissenters? So, note it.
Okay. One dissenter.
One dissenter.
Good night, then. I would have, but I won't have the opportunity.
Hopefully, Nick, you feel better.
Is Mary going to tell us why? Isn't that traditional?
Referred to earlier, and basically the basis for my dissent on the alternative view on the exposure graph, in terms of believing that the lots of information from having some entities not apply IFRS 9 is a cost that's greater than the concerns that were raised that I think could be addressed efficiently with the overlay.
I think it might just be worth clarifying as well that Ian's lack of opportunity is not because Hans is got all draconian, but because he isn't expected to be here when the document is taken from Alex.
What's the time frame? Can you time frame for the balloting process?
Well, the
any chance to sign before this?
Well, the issuance of the standard is expected in September, so which is after, unfortunately, when Ian finishes.
Okay.
You put up to help us ballot, Ian. We might.
We thank the team for its hard work for the good result. And then we move on to share-based payments. But is Nadia here already?
Some people are rushing onto the room to make fun.
Of course.